This is the Breaker.News podcast for the week of February 23rd, 2020. I'm Bob Mackin, publisher of the Breaker.News and host of the Breaker.News podcast. Welcome to edition number 122. The Breaker is your source for news, opinion, and analysis about British Columbia issues, institutions, and influencers. Later, I'll tell you how you can support The Breaker. On this edition, I continue with this month's special coverage of the 10th anniversary of the Vancouver 2010 Winter Olympics. John Furlong floats a trial balloon. The man who was CEO of the Vancouver Olympics says Vancouver should bid to host the 2030 Winter Olympics. I ask Andy Yan, the director of the Simon Fraser University City Program, what he thinks. Plus, mountain biking legend Hans No Way Ray debuts his Trans Hong Kong documentary at the Vancouver International Mountain Film Festival in North Van. And headlines from the Pacific Rim and the Pacific Northwest. Now, the Is It Just Me commentary. Is it just me, or should John Furlong's days playing with taxpayer dollars be over? The former CEO of the Vancouver 2010 Winter Olympics used his podium at a Board of Trade breakfast on February 20th to float a trial balloon. Let's bid for the 2030 Winter Olympics, he says. Furlong wants to celebrate the 20th anniversary of the Vancouver 2010 Games by hosting another Games. He suggested it would help Vancouver build affordable housing and more transit to solve the housing crisis and traffic congestion. Hold on here. Furlong thinks Vancouver needs to host another Olympics in order to solve the problems created by the first Vancouver Olympics. That's absurd. For now, Furlong's idea has no business case behind it, so there is no formal proposal for public funding. When voters in 1988 host Calgary rejected a bid for the 2026 Games, the cost there in 2018 was estimated at $5 billion. We're looking at about the same thing for Vancouver for 2030. Vancouver Mayor Kennedy Stewart has already insisted on a referendum. There was one in 2003 when a majority of people in the city of Vancouver who showed up to vote that day said yes, but citizens around the region would demand a say on a 2030 bid, and such a vote would be held under new campaign finance rules. For instance, Bob Rennie wouldn't be allowed to buy full-page newspaper ads every day for 2 weeks like he did way back in 2003. So, already 2002 host Salt Lake City and 1972 host Sapporo, Japan have expressed interest in bidding for 2030. The IOC is scheduled to pick the 2030 host when it meets in India in 2023. Problem is, Vancouverites will not get a chance until the year 2025 to see the agendas and minutes of VanOck board meetings. They're kept secret, hidden from the public eye at the Vancouver Archives, along with executive payroll and procurement information. Who really profited from Vancouver 2010? Furlong and VanOck thrived on secrecy the first time around, so why should they get another chance to spend billions of dollars before showing us how they performed the first time around? Even though it was backed by taxpayers, VanOck was officially a private company and not subject to the FOI law. After the Games, the Auditor General of British Columbia, John Doyle, decided not to investigate whether taxpayers got value for money or whether there was waste or corruption. Corruption seems to go wherever the Olympics do. VanOck never held a public board meeting and disappeared in 2014, claiming it balanced a $2 billion budget. Another reason why Furlong can't be trusted with taxpayers' money? Well, he didn't tell the truth about his own life in his 2011 published post-games memoir, Patriot Hearts. He omitted the part of his life about his first visit to Canada in 1969 as a volunteer gym teacher in a northern BC elementary school. That led to a Georgia Strait expose by Laura Robinson in 2012, which included allegations that Furlong had abused some of those students. Furlong has always denied those allegations, but the allegations were never tested in court. A half dozen of his ex-students still accuse the RCMP of bungling the investigation because they're Aboriginal and because Furlong headed the Olympics, which included a $900 million assignment for the RCMP to lead security. Canada's Human Rights Tribunal could hold public hearings on their complaints this year. So, John Furlong wants Vancouverites to open their wallets again for another merry-go-round with a five-ring circus, at a time when there are actually more homeless people in the Lower Mainland than there were athletes at the Olympic Village in Vancouver 2010. What do you think? Email me, Bob at thebreaker.news. Now it's time on the Breaker.News podcast for Around the Rim and Cascadia Calling, Olympic style. A look at news headlines, past and present, from around the Pacific Rim and around the Pacific Northwest. Back in May 2011, I reported in the Tyee.ca about BC's billion-dollar false alarm, about daily Olympics security reports that tracked protests and wingnuts, but there were no credible terrorist threats. We learned about valuable information about the Vancouver 2010 Winter Olympics from Julian Assange's WikiLeaks, who obtained documents from Bradley Manning, now known as Chelsea Manning. A common theme in the 17 days of situation reports was that there was no specific credible threat to the security of the games, only the prospect of small-scale organized protests. There was also unseasonably warm weather. A fellow named Gregory Marks was deported by Canadian Border Police. He had an inert hand grenade with him, plus pornography and plans to paraglide into the opening ceremony at BC Place Stadium. Trouble was, the stadium had an inflatable roof. You couldn't get in. Vice President Joe Biden came for the opening ceremony. Department of Homeland Security Secretary Janet Napolitano led a U.S. delegation for the end of the games. At the opening ceremony, police arrested a 48-year-old man who entered the building with a homemade media pass. The man tried to get near Vice President Biden. 2 days later, Biden's motorcade was in a minor chain reaction crash that sent two people to hospital with minor injuries. The U.S. government had a temporary security coordination office near the consulate in downtown Vancouver that was connected to the temporary Olympic Operations Center at Bellingham Airport and the RCMP and Canadian Forces control rooms in Richmond. There were threats that luckily didn't pan out. There were also comedic incidents. RCMP officers were puzzled when they found a map of Coke machines at the Whistler Olympic Village on February 18, 2010. A week later, a U.S. bobsledder was arrested. However, Bill Schuffenhofer's charges of assaulting and threatening his fiancée were later stayed. Canada called upon the U.S. Postal Inspection Service to send a mobile mail screening trailer to detect any physical, chemical, biological, radiological, nuclear, or explosive threat. However, Canada Post workers were snowed under by a flood of 16,000 bogus Team Canada and NHL jerseys in small quantity packages. The biggest shipment was 20 jerseys. As for future Olympics, Tokyo hosts the 2020 Summer Games beginning July 24th. The Japan Times reported that volunteer training was postponed because of the coronavirus outbreak. And organizers there have been at pains to stress there is no question of canceling or postponing Tokyo 2020, despite mounting fears over the potentially deadly virus spreading fast around the globe. There are about 100 cases in Japan, with 3 deaths, and more than 600 positive cases found aboard a cruise ship moored in Yokohama. The International Olympic Committee has also said there is no need for a contingency plan to postpone, cancel, or move Tokyo 2020, despite new cases of the deadly virus emerging daily in Japan. Nevertheless, sporting events have been affected by the virus in Japan and around the region. The Tokyo Marathon on March 1st has been restricted to athletes who are elites only, while a Paralympics test event for Bushido was scaled down with international athletes asked not to attend. The next Winter Games, they're in Beijing in 2022. Inside the Games.biz reported that key Beijing and IOC officials held a video conference to discuss preparations. Despite coronavirus, they are both confident the Games will not be affected. The first official Beijing 2022 test event, an International Ski Federation Alpine Skiing World Cup, scheduled this month in Yancheng, was cancelled due to the outbreak. Organizers have also had to delay the homologation process at the new National Sliding Center, while the Japanese Olympic Committee called off a planned visit to Beijing 2022 venues. Chinese organizers are scheduled to reveal designs this year for athlete medals, torches, and the torch relay route, along with hiring of a team to create the opening and closing ceremonies. Meanwhile, this week in the Breaker.News, these headlines. Trudeau and co. spent $54,000 to fly west for a Liberal campaign ad shoot last August. This was in collaboration with David Malko of CTV News Vancouver. Justin Trudeau spent $800,000 on flights aboard the Canadian Air Force's Challenger jets from May to August 2019. The last trip, on August 29th and 30th, was built around a Liberal Party campaign ad shoot on Grouse Mountain in North Vancouver, and it cost taxpayers $54,000 to fly Trudeau and his entourage. And NDP slaps 7% tax on soda pop and e-commerce in new budget. NDP Finance Minister Carol James claimed she would balance a $60 billion budget in the next fiscal year. Beginning July 1st, carbonated soft drinks will be subject to the provincial sales tax. E-commerce companies doing more than $10,000 of business in BC will have to register and collect the PST also beginning July 1st. Read these stories and more in thebreaker.news.
British Columbia, 2010.
You gotta be here.
This is the Big Deal feature on the Breaker.News podcast. It was supposed to be a celebration of the 10th anniversary of the Vancouver 2010 Winter Olympics. Instead, John Furlong, the 2010 Games CEO, floated a trial balloon. He thinks Vancouver should bid for the 2030 Winter Olympics. He said so on February 20th at the Fairmont Hotel Vancouver to the Greater Vancouver Board of Trade.
These are the challenges of our times: unaffordable housing, not enough housing, people sleeping on the streets, better transportation, huge challenges for us. Governments, even with the very best of intentions, are struggling to solve these problems. Challenges so big that sometimes it feels like we are even in retreat. So much to do. And you know what? Finger pointing is just so darn unbecoming of us. We shouldn't be doing it. It's no one's fault. It's everyone's responsibility, though. Together, we can do something. This is the challenge that will require unity and innovation and collaboration and selflessness and new leaders and an attitude of absolutely everybody in. It's on all of us. And Olympic Games, again, could do as it did already once and bring us all together. It could unite our governments, inspire corporate goodwill, and ignite citizen engagement. A nonpartisan, all-hands-on-deck focus to go beyond a shining oasis on a hill and become the most livable place on Earth. This is a vision with which I think we could win the Games. A vision we could achieve, which is within our grasp, I believe. A vision powerful enough to inspire us every day and be our coat of armor against the kinds of things, the adversity that will surely come our way, as it always does. We have all the Games venues, all of them. Some are the best in the world. Some are better than the day we built them.
Lack of affordable housing, homelessness, traffic congestion. The 2010 Games were supposed to solve these problems. Vancouver Mayor Kennedy Stewart said a bid would need federal and BC government support, plus a referendum. Premier John Horgan had this to say.
I certainly take a look at it, but this needs to come from Vancouver. It needs to come from the community. It's not something that we'll be initiating.
So how can Vancouverites look forward to 2030 when they don't yet know all the costs of 2010? To discuss this, I welcome Andy Yan, the director of Simon Fraser University's City Program, to the Breaker.News podcast. Andy is an urban planner with degrees in geography and political science. I began asking Andy, about 10 years later, what was the impact of Vancouver and Vancouverites of the 2010 Winter Olympics?
Well, it's interesting because I think it's in reflecting what happened over the last 10 years. I think that it goes into, I think, this kind of moment of angst in the city and the region now. I think that the Olympics actually is an interesting kind of measuring point because of the fact that it actually, if you think about it, it actually closed, if you will, Vancouver's Expo years, that from 1986 and to 2010. I think it marked a certain epoch of Vancouver entering this world stage. And from 2010 to the present day, it is in it's right on the world stage. And I think that it has, I think, a mixed legacy. I think that part of it is really fundamentally how there are still things we still don't know about the full disclosure of what happened to make the Olympics occur, as well as the actual full cost of the Olympics, because it's not only about the layout for things like security and facilities, but the opportunity costs that were involved, the full expenses that were, if you will, subsidized by various levels of government. But I'd be very curious to see what it really costs, say, the city of Vancouver in terms of staffing and opportunity costs. Mm-hmm. So it's actually one that I think, you know, it has to have a careful amount of consideration about really what happened with the 2010 Olympics, because so much of it is still rather ambiguous or opaque compared to really should we or should we not pursue the Olympics for 2030? And so I think in one way, it's the, when we think about that legacy, perhaps it's at best to kind of argue that it's mixed, that yes, indeed, it brought in, I think, a certain set of new facilities, whether it's the Sea to Sky highway to the Olympic line, that, I mean, there's certainly that transportation legacy. But then at the same time, this is also the year, if you will, 2010, that really marked the epoch when housing becomes truly unaffordable. That, of course, housing affordability in Vancouver has been around for a fair amount of time, but that run up from 2010 to the present day, particularly to 2016, I think it marks an incredible point through which Vancouver housing prices reached new highs, and in particular in the city of Vancouver. But then you could also argue that it's there in the rest of the region.
As you pointed out, the affordability equation became very much an issue because Vancouver was on the world stage. It was a tourism and real estate promotion that succeeded in many ways, but it's also a place that became less affordable and less livable for Vancouverites. Talk about that that dichotomy.
The Olympics brought in a certain level of excitement, and I mean, you certainly see it within within the streets of Vancouver. I think one estimate is that this is what Vancouver streets could look like if you had an influx of 100,000 people, 100,000 further people into the downtown core, and had that kind of amazing activity there. But then again, it goes into the question of at what cost, and I think that one of the interesting measures on this is actually the levels of homelessness, that really we're at all-time highs when it comes to the homeless population in Vancouver. And it kind of marks the question of not only what is remembered, but who is forgotten. And I think that that is one of the rather profound challenges that we are facing in 2020. In Vancouver of 2020, I think, is a lot different of, say, Vancouver in 2010, or let's say Vancouver, 2000, I think, when was the referendum for the 2010 Olympics?
2003.
Then Vancouver 2003. And I think that it's in that mix, I think that it goes into a discussion of, do we constantly need these world spectacles to jumpstart our economy, to tell us who we are, how we fit in the world? And I think that that's something that is oddly, I think, a state of Vancouver, whereby we seemingly are in constant need of this kind of affirmation of who we are or what we're becoming. And I think that it's one through which I think elicits a certain level of insecurity that I think is a larger challenge for our region and for our civic leadership.
The Vancouver Games housed 2,700 athletes. Mm-hmm. Here we are in 2020, and recent Metro Vancouver homeless counts are that there's about 3,300 homeless in the Metro Vancouver area. So you contrast those two numbers, it is quite shocking.
Right. And I think unfortunately it also talks about how, in a way, I think it was more so, I think, after 2010 that Vancouver becomes a tale of two regions, one that is prosperous, one that of wealth in tremendous abounds. But then at the same time, there is this other side of the region that has emerged that really faces new levels of homelessness, challenges around addiction, and I think the ongoing issues around economic development and how many people are either precariously employed or underemployed that really, I think, are masked in terms of the statement that we face really low levels of unemployment. But then I think it's going into actually how the Olympics, I think, really marked, I think, the ongoing challenges of really the unshared prosperity that's occurred in the region.
What do you say about this trial balloon about Vancouver even looking at 2030? Should it happen again?
It's funny because certainly the word trial balloon has been like used a lot in this, and I couldn't help myself but think about that. You know that song that was in the 1980s, the 99 red blooms. Mm-hmm. Like I couldn't help but kind of have that bounce around in the back of my head about. And it's an interesting song by Nina back in the day in the 80s. And if you actually go through the lyrics about 99 balloons, red balloons, it's actually one about like actually how it marked actually their profound concerns about what was happening in the world, about this kind of world that was actually it was during the Cold War that really, I think, really marked the kind of angst in terms of the ideas of what was going on. And I think that really where we are today, I think fundamentally brings, I think, together a much different city and a much different region, I think, through which I think it's, you would think we are stepping away from these types of jump starts in the real estate and the tourism industry into other types of economic activity that you think could generate, I think, greater levels of a shared prosperity in the region. And I think that to that extent, I think it asks, like, do we really need these mega events to really tell us or define who we are compared to, I think, other more sustainable, thoughtful, I think, in-depth kind of actions that we really can leverage and become that region that we aspire to be.
That was Andy Yan, director of the city program at Simon Fraser University. The Vancouver International Mountain Film Festival is on until March 1st. On February 22nd, mountain biking pioneer Hans No Way Ray was at the Centennial Theatre in North Vancouver for the world premiere of his new film. The mountain bike Hall of Famer from Germany now lives in Laguna Beach, California. Since his competitive career ended more than 20 years ago, Ray has traveled the world making mountain biking adventure films. The latest is called Trans Hong Kong Urban Adventure. It captures 5 days riding from the peaks to beaches and through the skyscrapers of Hong Kong. Ray was there at a pivotal moment in Hong Kong history. Ray and his cameraman found themselves amid some of the pro-democracy protests last fall.
Well, I just love the contrast between, you know, that nature and harmony right outside of the city on the islands, and then you have this urban jungle and these over 7,000 high-rise buildings and skyscrapers. It's pretty impressive, the skyline in Hong Kong, and the traffic and the people, and then mixing in the whole protests, which we really tried to avoid, but we happened to be there at the height of the protest, was quite an interesting element to have, you know, on our ride. And I was really impressed by the quality of purpose-built biking trails they actually had there all over Hong Kong, like surrounding the city.
And it also captures history in Hong Kong, as you rode right into streets where there was social unrest, the protests you experienced. Talk about that, a unique kind of incident while you're doing one of your videos that you've done in other cities.
Yeah, that's right. We were there at some turbulent times last November, and I've been doing adventure trips for the last 25 years to the remote corners of the world, but lately I discovered these urban adventures, and I picked these big cities that have incredible nature left and right, and Hong Kong is one of them. And we traverse basically the city from one side to the other, and in the middle we go to the cities. And yeah, the protests were going on, and it was quite wild because you never knew where they would pop up. You know, it wasn't just like one protest on a Saturday afternoon where everybody meets. You know, these protests, they pop up like wildfire, and all of a sudden a neighborhood would turn upside down, and traffic would collapse, and shop windows would be broken, and tear gas would be in the air, and people would be running, and then you walk around the corner and life was normal, and people would just like mind their everyday business. So it was quite interesting.
Yeah, you indicate that, this could be a pivotal time for Hong Kong, that it may be more difficult for people to go to Hong Kong in future and enjoy the city as you did and adventure around the city, that because of the political turbulence there and political changes, it may be less friendly to adventurers.
Well, just to people in general, and especially the people living there, I think. But yes, the city goes definitely through a lot of changes, and it might never be the same. That's true.
Heavy police everywhere.
Heavy police presence, so we're going to try and avoid that section of town.
I think it's not very wise to go there and get mixed up, because it's been getting quite serious. They are shooting rubber bullets, tear gas. They have the SWAT team in there. There's all kinds of rubbish and litter on the streets. People are running very quickly there. I think we need to get out of here right now. Well, look, people are running on the sidewalk.
The bridge here.
Don't go there.
Yeah,
wait.
Right there.
Where?
Oh, yeah,
let's
go there.
Yeah, let's not go there.
Just a couple of blocks away, life seems completely normal. People dine, shop, and exercise like any other day. We finish our day watching the beautiful Symphony of Lights show on the skyscrapers and indulge in some typical local food.
Those were sounds from Trans Hong Kong Adventure, and that was Hans Ray, producer of Trans Hong Kong Adventure. He was in Vancouver for the Vancouver International Mountain Film Festival, which runs until March 1st at various venues. The virtual Nanaimo Bar, brought to you by Spruce Hill Contracting. Every week we end the Breaker.News podcast on a tasty note by awarding the goodness of a virtual Nanaimo Bar to a person or group that has made a difference. A virtual version of the province's favorite dessert bar goes this week to the athletes of the Vancouver 2010 Winter Olympics. 10 years ago, in February 2010, there were more than 2,600 athletes from 82 nations competing in 86 events in 7 sports. Canada set a record for host country gold medals with 14. The United States set a record for most medals overall with 37. You can nominate someone for a virtual Nanaimo Bar. Send me an email to bob@thebreaker.news. Spruce Hill Contracting, custom homes and renovations. Find more information at sprucehill.ca. That's it for the Breaker.News podcast for the week of February 23rd, 2020. I'm Bob Mackin. Thanks for joining me. And thank you to my guests, Andy Yan of SFU and mountain biking filmmaker Hans Ray. Did you know that on February 23rd in 2010, it was day 12 of the 2010 Winter Olympics in Vancouver? Canada's Ashley McIver won the first women's ski cross gold medal in the Olympics at Cypress Mountain. It was the third of 4 gold medals won by Canadians at the West Vancouver venue, where snow was trucked in from 100 miles away because of spring-like conditions. 10 years later, Cypress Mountain has ideal February conditions. Go visit it. Now you know. Send me your feedback. Send me your story ideas to bob@thebreaker.news. Bookmark thebreaker.news. You can also find us at thebreaker.ca. Sign up for the email newsletter and get updates to your inbox. For news as it happens, follow The Breaker News on Twitter and visit TheBreaker.News on Facebook. You can support The Breaker for as little as $2 a month. For more information, go to patreon.com/TheBreakerNews. That's patreon.com/TheBreakerNews. Until next week.